Now, in our situation here, we are dealing here with a transformational media. The traditional name for it was magic. But I think you should understand that you could just as well call it psychic energy. If symbols dealt with the mind, and if mythology dealt with the imagination, the magic section deals with the psyche. Notice here that the imagination is related to, but distinctly different from the psyche. But if you don't have the strategic perspective, which this complete ecology of learning, which this complete cycle of teaching makes available to you, if you don't have that strategic perspective, one would tend to go off and think that, well, the relationship of imagination to psyche must be that imagination is a function of the psyche. And right away, one objectifies the psyche and one makes imagination a subsumed subsidiary of an objectivized psyche. And I must tell you that this simply is not the case. It is never the case. There's no such thing as the psyche. The psyche is a transformational media. It's not an object. And because it's a transformational media, it has its flow power. And its flow power is meant to work, literally to work. What is the truth of the psyche? The truth of the psyche is that if it's healthy, it works. If it's diseased, it tends not to work or to work in aberrant ways. And if it doesn't work at all, you're dead. Now, to try and objectivize the psyche and say that it is an astral double of your body, or that it's some kind of, it is the soul, all of this, these are misunderstandings. These are wonderful images which one can form in your imagination about the psyche. But to think that they're in any way true deceives yourself. It's a self-deception on a very major order. So if you're thinking of it in terms of psyche, think of it in terms of psychic energy. It's the energy. It's the energeia. And that the psyche is like a pure energy, if you like. You can call it consciousness if you get into a conceptual problem. Call it consciousness. The psychic energy and the imagination are both transformational media. They both work when they're working, but they're not objectively there. You can't ever stop them to find them. So that the correct way of working with them is to participate with them, to be in the flow, as it were. And one of the very best writers on this incident, it was William James. And his phrase, stream of consciousness, is a very accurate phrase, stream of consciousness. The flow of psychic energy is like a stream of consciousness. And just so, the imagination is like a stream of feeling consciousness, which expresses itself in images, so that an image base can be teased out of the transformational media of the imagination. But the mode of teasing them out is through feeling. So that if you're working with imagination, if you're working with that realm, the very best expressive mode of using that transformational media is to use music. And of course, because you're using the human body, you want to put the human body into the music mode. So dance. Dance. So the kind of traditional way that human beings, in a very comprehensive way, have always dealt with imagination is that they will center their culture on their danced music, and the images that come out of that will be the images that they will live by. And whatever pattern those images are able to form in a kind of a feeling intelligent pattern, that will be the skeleton of the culture. The culture will be built on that skeletal shape. And I must say, you couldn't be prouder of our ancestors, because they very accurately understood this. World round, all of our ancestors understood this. And you can find this in any area of the world. And human beings thrived when they knew this, when they did this. Their lives were as full as could be at that particular capacity. There is an indelible tendency in the image base to begin to, let me use a term here, to begin to conjure a sense of center. If you've danced those dances long enough, you begin to understand that there is a pivotal center to all the movements that you're doing. The pivotal center is not in some place in the room or in some place in nature, but the pivotal center moves with you. It's somewhere in you. So that the center of the image base inevitably begins to disclose to human beings that they are carrying a movable pivot within themselves. The center of all of those movements, the center of that image base, is within themselves. And this, in a very natural way, produces a kind of interiorization of meaning, a reflexiveness, and it's that character, that reflexiveness, that interiority that creates the mind. The mind is created out of that. And the mind is objective. The mind emerges out of the transformational media of the imagination. But the mind that emerges is of such a nature that it's like it's objectively there, but objectively there like lightning is objectively there. It's not there very long. It doesn't maintain its characteristic shape very long. It's there like a lightning flash. And while it's there, the mind accurately personifies the energy that went into making it. And part of that personification is not to keep it, but to give it back out again. So that the mind, while it's objective, it's like an hourglass. Whatever it receives, it is lightning like that, and then gives it out again. Like that kind of a thing. What it gives out is psychic energy. The psychic energy is the mind's radiation. So while the mind emerges from the imagal base of feeling comprehension, it's just lightning like there for a little bit and gives out psychic energy. So that to the naive, it seems as if these are the same thing. to make the differentiation between those two transformational media is a very high level yogic activity. To know that they're different is really something. And to be able to investigate that difference over a long duration of time so that one can see the characteristics which differentiate and also relate them, this is strenuous. This is a very strenuous activity. In traditional wisdom literature, this peculiar quality of the mind being a lightning balance between the images and the psychic energy was disclosed in a very characteristic way. The way that it was disclosed was the experience of looking eye to eye at the inner person. That your eyes, as your person, would look eye to eye with the eyes of your inner person. That kind of experience. Now I'll give you two examples from world tradition just so that you can see for yourself, well, yes, this is indeed so. It's not a speculation on my part. This is indeed so. The first example is from the Kina Upanishad, which was written somewhere around 600 BC in northern India. And I'm using the Radhakrishnan translation of the Upanishads. It's in his book, The Principal Upanishads. This is on page 583. The Kina Upanishad has four sections. This is in the first section. They're called khandas in India. The first khanda. The first khanda has nine parts, and this is the eighth part of the nine. The first khanda of the Kina Upanishad, having nine parts, has it divided 4-5. The first four parts are a cross-section of the quaternary of the inner self. And the next five are that quaternary put into motion, so that the next five are the five-phase energy cycle. In India, it doesn't have the same form that it had in China. It's the same transformation process, but it has a different form. In India, it's called the five koshas, five sheaths. So this being, this is number seven. So the first four is the quaternary of the self. The next five is the transformation cycle. So 4, 5, 6, 7. So that this seventh is the middle part of the transformational process. So what we're talking about here is the very pivot on which the transformational process of the self works. How does it work? In deep yoga, one can see that it always follows this kind of ecological phase transformation. And at the center, at the fulcrum of that phase transformation is this experience given in this kind of an expression. And here's the Kina Upanishad's expression. And then I'll complement it by using a first century AD collection of hymns, Jewish hymns. They're called the Odes of Solomon. Here's the Kina Upanishad. That which is not seen by the eye, but by which the eyes are seen, that verily know thou is Brahman, and not what people here worship. That which is not seen by the eye, but by which the eyes are seen, that verily know thou is Brahman, and not what people here worship. It's the experience that when your eye sees your inner eye, it's like an experience that your eye sees your inner eye looking at you. But when your eye sees your inner eye and those two eyes meet, the pupil of both eyes records nothing. There's no image in either one, which simply means that there's no worldly kind of objectivity whatsoever that's happening. Now, in the Odes of Solomon, which deals with the inner self archetypal, it hasn't yet been tagged yet to Jesus as the Christ. It's still in the deep archetypal experience of first century Judaism. This is the 13th Ode of Solomon. Behold, the Lord is our mirror. Open your eyes and see them in him and learn the manner of your face. Then announce praises to his spirit and wipe the paint from your face and love his holiness and put it on. Then you will be unblemished at all times with him. Hallelujah. Behold, the Lord is our mirror. Open your eyes and see them in him and learn the manner of your face. Then announce praises to his spirit and wipe the paint from your face and love his holiness and put it on. Then you will be unblemished at all times with him. Hallelujah. So here from the Odes of Solomon and the Kina Upanishad, you have the quintessential center of the transformational process. Now, it's difficult in the Upanishadic literature or in the Hellenistic Jewish literature for us to acclimate ourselves to them. We can understand them intellectually. That's not really a problem for us. We have tremendous intellect. But we do not have the cultural guts, as it were, to be able to do this in those ways. We don't have the total immersion culturally in those civilizations enough to be able to live out accurately in our feelings and in our psychic energy these happenings. We can understand them as ideas, but we cannot live those experiences. But there is a way for us to live the version that the Chinese Taoists have. There is a way for that to happen for us. Now, the reasons for this are arcane, and they're one of the great merciful accidents of history, if you wish. At any rate, we can use the Chinese Taoist. Now, the Taoist transformation cycle is in the Tao Te Ching, and it's chapter 42. And I love to use this old D.T. Suzuki word for character Chinese transliteration of it. And I'll just give it to you again. This is Tao's transformation. Tao produces unity. Unity produces duality. Duality produces Trinity. Trinity produces the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things bear the negative principle and embrace the positive principle. The 10,000 things bear the yin. It's usually said in traditional translations, they bear the yin on their back and embrace the yang. But it isn't like it's on your back, but it's like whatever action is yang, the back of that action is yin. Now, if you can follow this esoterically for a moment, if this hand moving is yang, the space behind it is yin. Notice that it's embracing the yin. Notice that the yin is always not only behind it, but what is being embraced also. So that the only way that the yang ever occurs objectively is within a context of yin. Now, if you put this in diagrammatical form, you say that the only way you can have a yang line is to have it in between two yin lines. It's the only way to really grasp, expressively grasp, what that yang is. And the same thing for the yin. The yin as the space on the back of the moving hand is unseen until one puts another yang behind it. Then the space, the receptive space, now is able to be seen. But the yin, diagrammatically, can only be seen as a broken line in between two unbroken lines. It's the only way. Notice here. Notice here, this is exactly what Lao Tzu says, that the two produces the three. Duality produces the Trinity. That is to say, in the basic principle, the two-ness is unstable. Not in a derisive way, but in its characteristic nature. It's not a negative. It's not a subtle positive. It's neutrally its real nature, that the two, the duality, always produces the three. Always tends to objectify itself, always tends to manifest its further nature, so that the two always makes the three. And when you have the three, then you have enough objectivization, enough ideation, so that the three makes the 10,000 things. It makes whatever there is. It makes an infinite multitude. The principle of the three makes whatever is possible, whatever else is possible. Notice here that in the Chinese, they preserve a contextual form of expression which is somewhat lost to us in the Kina Upanishad and in the Odes of Solomon. We can recover it. And once you understand, you can go to this kind of material and you can see these people were extremely accurate. The first century AD Jews who became the earliest Christians were extremely accurate. The Kina Upanishad rishis, who became the first generation that produced the Buddha, were extremely accurate. These are fantastically accurate people. But our problem is that we can't get into their families very easily. We can't become a member of their way of living very easily. We tend to grasp what they mean with our minds alone, as ideas. And this, in a very subtle way, makes us incapacitated to actually live our own lives, and inflates our minds and makes us dependent upon a mental characterization of reality, which then subconsciously has a detriment because we're unable to live it. And the more powerfully your mind goes out of balance and dominates the situation, the less capacity you have to actually live it. So one has to have that balance there. The Chinese Taoist produces that balance so that we do not understand it intellectually until we are able to live it. This is due to partly to the genius of Lao Tzu, partly to the genius of the way that the Chinese were able to put this into the I Ching. And the I Ching is not able to be understood intellectually until one can live it. I've never met a single person who, in knowing enough about what was going on, would claim to know any more about the I Ching than they were able to live. I remember one time eating a meal with Kai D. And I was lost in the conversation in an intellectual way, and I was eating my dessert, which was an orange, and I was putting the orange peel down on the plate. And he simply pointed with a finger and he said, "That's the other side of the orange. It's also edible." I never considered eating the orange peel. I had never considered it was the other side of the orange. Do you know that orange peel is edible? Do you know that it naturally cleans out the system? Do you know that it is, in fact, the other side of the orange from that activity of what you're throwing away to use this? Why not? You could just as well throw this away and use that. But the best is to use it all, because that's what is for. It's to use. It's like an insight into the transformation process. It's not anything to think about, other than that when you're doing it, then you think about it. But if you think about it and not do it, that's an imbalance. Or if you do it and don't think about it, that's an imbalance. There, the thought in the doing, the mind and life in a transformation process are in sync. And when they're in sync, they work incredibly well. They work in such a refined way. Well, the I Ching is such a form, an expressive form, that it forbids your intellectual understanding of it to outstrip your ability to live with it. And so you have to live with it a long time. It's like Confucius says, very subtly, that he wished that he had another 50 years of life to study the I Ching. In other words, he had no problem being an intellectual giant. Confucius, tremendous intellectual giant. But he was saying, I have understood this book, and it's not something that you can just understand. You have to live with it. So that in Lao Tzu, whenever the two occurs, whenever the yang moving carries the yin upon its back, in order to objectivize it, you have to have a third element. You have to have another hand behind that to see that space, or you have to see that the space before the hand is the same as the space behind, and thus the hand emerges. That is to say, that form occurs always in the background context of the formless. When one is really sharp about this, there never is a form without a context of formlessness. That is a part of the essential definition of the form. That when you come to define the form, the formlessness that is with the form is a part of that form. That's the wholeness of the situation. Now you can see right away, some of you who work with this can see what a brilliant insight this is. Because when you're dealing with psychic energy, that also means that the psychic energy is a transformational media, has a context in which it works. Its form is in the context of, on one side, the mind, and on the other side, whatever complements the mind. What complements the mind? The psychic energy flows from the mind as a transformational media to what? To the person. In between the mind and the person is where the psychic energy is. It's not geographically here in this head. It's not in the brain. Do you understand how subtle this little bit of a twist gives you a strategic insight into what is real? The psychic energy is not in, it's not here. If you want to put a fulcrum objectively, the tradition of putting the heart, the Anahata chakra, is much more accurate in the sense that that psychic energy occurs as a transformational process between the mind and the person. This whole body is an expressive vehicle for the person. And in just the same way, in just the same kind, this whole body is an expressive vehicle for the mind. So that psychic energy, when it occurs in its fullness, is rather like that ratio of person and mind. Person and mind together as an archetypal ratio. Whatever that ratio is, that relationality is the psychic energy. You can express it in that kind of a mathematical formula. It gives a whole new meaning to whole person energy. You can see right away that it's so profound. It's fraught with possibilities. Once one is able to accurately not only understand this, but to live this, then the psychic energy as a transformational process is available to you as a communicating mode. It's an energy, and any energeia, has a communicative, bridging mode possibility. There never is a telepathy mind to mind that it isn't also person to person. There is never an instance of telepathy from a mind to a person. Mind to mind and person to person, it's always like that. So that when one's psychic powers, for instance, are attenuated in the deep self experience, the siddhi, the yogic powers, when they're attenuated in the deep self experience, one never has the sense that God is not a person. Or, if God is cosmic, you are also cosmic. Your person is also cosmic. It's like that. It's like that correlation is instantaneous and exact. However you experience your person, you experience God that way. The all or the nothing. It can be either way, incidentally. It could be either way. It just depends on your cultural situation, actually. It depends on the image base. However that came in, it's all or nothing. Tolstoy, in a beautiful way when he was old, said, the only way that I can have learned to express God is not to use any kind of a name, but to use a ratio, X over zero. The unknown over zero. He said, I understand this for myself, that this is the potent experience that I have found in myself. That God presence in myself, I can write and express it X over zero, unknown over zero. It's in his last diaries. He was, 80 years old when he did that. In the I Ching, when we go to the I Ching, the structural core of the I Ching discloses to us why this is so. The beautiful thing about the I Ching is that we are able to live it and understand it quite accurately in our own lives. We can use it in our lives and understand it with our minds. We, incidentally, are better able to do this than the Chinese. I don't know if you know this or not, but we are better able to do this than the Chinese. It's an accident of the history of consciousness. Look, the Wilhelm Baines edition of the I Ching has sold several million copies in its English-speaking edition. It's almost still an unknown esoteric book in China. There are not millions of Chinese reading the I Ching. There are not even thousands reading the I Ching. Do you not know this? We're reading the I Ching. The West is reading the I Ching. What are the Chinese reading? The Chinese are busy reading mathematic books, Western mathematic books, by the millions. Because there has been, on a very deep level, on the deepest level, an exchange of selves. One of the characteristics of a world unity, time, is that there is a secret exchange of selves. And the I Ching, in its structure, discloses for us exactly and quite accurately how this occurs and why this occurs. For the yang to occur objectively at all, it must be in a context of yin. And if you express it, then to have a yang line, you can't just write the yang line. You have to write the yang line in the context of two yin lines, one before it and one after it. But when you have three lines, to the Chinese mind, which is extremely practical, you have then three places, like three decimal places, that must be filled all the time then. And the Chinese mind sees that, well, the yang line can occur, does occur, most naturally in the center, but because it's expressive of a all-Quran transformation process, it at one time is in the first place, another time is in the second place, another time is in the third place. So that one can also then, as part of the reality of the script of writing out the accurate delineation of that transformation process, write it yang line to yin line. And in fact, that's the first way to write it, because when one is following this through, one writes it yang line, two yin lines, then a yin line, a yang line, a yin line, and then two yin lines and the yang line. That's the true movement. It occupies all of those spaces. What are those spaces? They're like energy levels. It's like electrons. You remember when we were kids, they used to call the atomic structure electron shells? Yeah. They caught that from Kabbalistic mysticism, incidentally. The whole thing of the shells. And it's not like shells, it's like energy levels. They don't exist in shells, but they live in energy levels which are exact. They're exact to almost, you can decimal them out into such small fractions that you couldn't follow it any further. Should we change the machines?
No, we don't need them.
Okay. It's like energy which occurs in this transformational media objectivizes itself in specific, mathematically specific potentialities, which are the points, or which are the places. And just so, the Chinese genius saw that in the yin-yang transformational sequence, the yang occupies the first place, then the second, then the third. You may be in a filtered and factored situation where you're only using the second place yang all the time, but nevertheless, in truth, that second place is an occurrence where the other two are actually occurring also. It's just that they're not being counted now. They're invisible now. One's not paying attention to them now. But they are still there. Lao Tzu says that, he says the usefulness of the cup is the space in between. But you wouldn't have a space in between unless you had the cup. So like a Taoist, understanding this, knows that you use the space by holding the form. Or you can use the form by holding the space. So there are three potentialities when you abstract out this form, when you use the mind to make the idea symbolically of what is going on, the transformation sequence has yang at the beginning, yang at the middle, yang at the end. And because each of these occur in reality. There's also, one has to take into consideration a fourth part which doesn't move. It's like the stillness which is always there, and that is the yang in the first place, the yang in the second place, the yang in the third place, abstracted out and made into three yang lines. That presence, the pure yang, is always wherever any yang manifestation. So that when you come to write the trigrams, you write it in a series of four. When you write the yang progression in its symbolic truthfulness, the full and exact idea is to have four trigrams, the top one being the three yang lines, and the first one being yang at the bottom, the second one yang in the middle, and the third yang at the top, and then the three yang lines together. The same progression happens for the yin, so that when you come to understand the archetypal symbolic reality of the transformation process in Taoism, you get the eight trigrams of the I Ching. They occur, as it were, out of the natural truth of the accuracy of the symbolic perception. The three yang lines and the three yin lines are a true polarity. That true polarity is an invisible, abstracted element which doesn't occur in actuality. It's like potentially it always is available but never does actually occur. There's a big shock sometimes. There aren't many people who get to this, but it's a big shock to realize that there is no true polarity in the universe. If there were, nothing would work. That would not work. Whatever it was would not work if there were a true polarity. So one of the first and most powerful abstract ideas of the human race is the idea of polarity. Notice, polarity doesn't occur in life. Well, then what about the polarities of psychic energies that all the books have? What can I say? They all have to be revised. All of them? Yep. There's a lot of work to be done. The polarity is truly an abstract idea. But what is the actuality all the time is something very close to polarity, which the Chinese call complementarity, and that always is what is happening. That's always the case. There's always an exchange of energy going on. There's never a polarity in actual fact, but there's always some variation and inversion in the complementarity process, so that one has to train oneself to look with the comprehensiveness of the Taoist eye, as it were. This is where the Tao of science comes in, because 20th century physics has learned that the actual truth of it, the genius who brought this out was Niels Bohr. Not Einstein here, but Niels Bohr. You never knew a Dane could be so brilliant, but he was fantastic. His idea of complementarity, and along with the idea of complementarity, Bohr saw quite accurately in his mind that all energy then must exist in distinct, discrete quanta. And quantum mechanics, quantum theory came out of this. That in fact, even though we don't believe it, it must in fact be so. And if it is so, then there must be a way to calibrate energy accurately enough so that we can follow the atomic sequence of materia. And materia is like the yang of the universal process. The materia of the universe must occur in very distinct exact quantity. And in fact, not only is it discrete in quantity, but it's discrete in families of quantity. It's like if you put a table of all of the elements up, there'll be a periodicity, family charts. Well, these elements go together, these go together, these go together. Why? Because the energy discreteness tends to congregate itself in clusters. It's just a characteristic of the objectivity of the focus, so that all of the focuses that are nearby tend to cluster in a likeness and so on and so forth. It's incidentally a process that holds throughout the entire universe. Not only do elements on this planet cluster together, on any planet they cluster together. We better let the machines catch up. We got two more ideas and then we'll take a break.